ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
My son was born with a congenital heart defect, and it means that every 6 months for the rest of his life, we'll be going down to Perth to get that monitored because there's no equipment here for any of the doctors or specialists to do that monitoring.
Shortly, we head to a remote mining community in northern WA where residents are demanding a 2021 promise be fulfilled to upgrade its 57-year-old hospital. Tom Price residents are frequently being forced to travel hours away for health services that aren't available locally. And on the New South Wales South Coast, students at Bulleye High School are committed to learning more about the ocean and surfing. With its proximity to a world-class surf break, the school aims to become a top-class training ground for future champions.
We're about a 30-second walk to the beach. Most subjects we get to go down swimming and surfing is a big part of this school.
The school's expanded its surfing program in the hope of creating more national representatives in the sport. I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth. But firstly, the 3G mobile network will be shut down completely in Australia this year. Some residents in rural and remote areas are worried the end of 3G will mean a loss of phone service. Telstra is saying its customers will get the same or better service with 4 and 5G. But not all rural landholders are convinced, as David Claughton reports.
Residents in rural and remote areas are worried about losing phone service. But Telstra and Optus, who have the biggest coverage in regional areas, are both confident that customers will still be able to make calls after 3G is shut down. That doesn't wash with farmer Jane Porter, who lives at Yumanbar in the Tweed Valley in northern New South Wales. She used to have decent 3G service in her top paddocks, but that stopped when a new 4G tower was activated on a mountain nearby.
No. Every time they do an upgrade, those of us who live underneath the mountains get worse coverage.
Why do you think that is? We're hearing that from time to time now.
Well, supposedly they're projecting out to places like Mooloolambah, where you've got your population, and so they make that more powerful, they direct it more at them, which is a bit higher up, and because we're directly under, we lose it.
Ms Porter said she didn't have a copper landline to fall back on, as Telstra stopped maintaining that several years ago. She said Telstra advised her to wait for additional 4G towers to go up in her area. Beef breeder Danny Henderson is especially worried about landholders having access to a phone in emergencies. He's got a farm north of Adaminaby near Cooma in the Snowy Mountains area. His property is in a 3G black spot and Telstra wants to shut down his copper landline service as well. He's switched to a phone that runs off the farm's satellite Wi-Fi service, but it's unreliable.
You know, the copper line is going to be discontinued in the next couple of years. My concern with that is that, recent history has shown us that any of the satellite services aren't actually 100% reliable with environmental conditions.
What do you mean by that? Because you're in Cooma, it gets pretty cold there. You get snow. Is that one of the problems?
Yeah, that's right. Well, we're actually out of Cooma. We're up in the mountains, sort of more north of Adaminaby. And, snow is fairly relevant to us. It's not a big deal, but it does happen. But when it's snowing, the satellite services just don't function. And of course the other thing we've had in recent time is when the valley's full of smoke, the satellite, again, the signal doesn't get through.
In response to those concerns, Chris Taylor from Telstra said that more than 98% of the company's mobile towers had 4G technology now, and the rest would have new technology installed in the coming months. He said people are upgrading their handsets and any devices that rely on 3G.
The number of customers who are migrating their handsets to those that are going to be compatible on the 4G and 5G network is accelerating rapidly. And in fact, the 3G network now only carries about 1% of our total traffic. So the numbers are very small in comparison to the total number of devices out there. And we often find with a technology change, things will accelerate in the next 3 to 4 months with customers moving off those 3G-only handsets and non-compatible devices and taking up one that's going to work on our 4G and 5G technologies moving forward.
They're still getting plenty of people raising issues, though, about 3G, worried about the transition to 4G. And some people saying, we've got a new 4G tower in our area, but actually It's made our reception even worse. Now I can't get 3G. What do you think's going on there?
Yeah, well, firstly, we understand that there is a lot of emotion and concern around a technology change like this one, particularly in regional areas. I was around when we first launched the 3G network and closed the CDMA network. So we've got to do some stuff on the network side to get our customers ready, and we've got to give our customers time to understand the change and do things on that side.
The ACCC reported on the 3G shutdown last year and warned the telcos about problems associated with towers that only have 3G equipment. They want to see those upgraded as well. Here's Chris Taylor on the changes they're making to all of their towers.
For the last 2 years, Telstra, when they've been building new towers, predominantly, unless we've had a contract that makes us include 3G technology, our new towers have only been built with 4G on them. So any brand new towers will only be adding to the 4G coverage. So people may see that 4G is better than 3G in those areas. Where we've got a 3G tower that we've added 4G technology to, what we would expect is that once we've completed all of the optimization work, that our customers should be able to get 4G coverage in the same place as they can get 3G. What we mean by that is that where you can make a handheld phone call on the 3G network outdoors, and our coverage maps show that you can do that, you'll be able to do that on the 4G network, and that's our aim before we close the 3G network. On the sites where we've got 3G and 4G, we've got some optimization work to do. In some cases, we're changing antenna designs, and there are software changes in the network that will push that 4G coverage out to the extremities of 3G. So a whole range of things happening and have been happening for a while and will continue to happen up until June, but that's how we are going to get that equivalence.
And people have been paying to put on some extra technology, right, to boost the signal, but saying it's just not working, it's not making a difference, you know, sometimes thousands of dollars and not get a result.
There can be a range of, and we need to understand the specifics, and those people, we really want to have their details to be able to talk to them. And it can range from the repeater device they've installed hasn't been installed optimally. The antenna may not be facing the tower or the most optimal tower to get coverage. It could be settings on the repeater. It could be a whole range of things that could be impacting that, and we find that with different customers.
And it's important to remember that if you don't get a mobile signal today, you won't get one tomorrow either. Telstra have made it clear that this is not about extending the range of mobile service.
So this is not about us adding new mobile coverage and building new coverage. Where there are black spots today, when we close this, where people cannot access anything on the 3G network today, What we want people to be able to do is access the 4G network in the same places. We will not be, this is not about building new coverage.
Telstra will shut down their 3G network on June 30, and Optus will follow suit in September.
David Claughton with that report on the 3G shutdown.
You're listening to Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
And you are with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company. Remember, you can podcast the show or listen back to the program through the ABC Listen app. It's what we recommend. It is the best radio listening experience. Or you can also visit the Australia Wide website. Just search for ABC Australia Wide. To WA now, where there continues to be anger and frustration in the remote town of Tom Price over a delayed upgrade to the town's 57-year-old hospital. The state government and Rio Tinto committed more than $30 million towards the project just before the 2021 WA election. But in 3 years, there's been little progress. The government says the project has come under significant cost pressures due to changes in the building market. But Tom Price residents are running out of patience and sick of having to travel to Karratha or even Perth for health services not offered at the local hospital. It's especially frustrating for young mothers, as there are no maternity services at the hospital. Pilbara reporter Charlie McLean filed this report.
Tom Price residents think the delay is a slap in the face, given the region's mining exports contribute more than $35 billion to the state economy. Tom Price mother Samantha Robbins doesn't want to wait much longer.
My son was born with a congenital heart defect, And it means that every 6 months for the rest of his life, we'll be going down to Perth to get that monitored, because there's no equipment here for any of the doctors or specialists to do that monitoring.
Another local, Melissa Wright, spent months in Perth last year for breast cancer treatment. Her stay had to be extended because her doctors had concerns about the Tom Price Hospital.
It was a long, long wait to go down, have medical treatment, not being able to come back because they couldn't risk any problems. There wasn't, at our hospital, they knew there wasn't adequate medical services.
The hospital has defended its health services, acknowledging that it's an old facility, but saying it continues to provide quality services. Meanwhile, a spokesperson for the state government says it's committed to the upgrades, but there's been significant cost increases which have stalled the project. But Shire President Audra Smith said cost blowouts were no excuse for the delay.
You know, the budget's looking very healthy, so why have we not got a hospital? You know, our miners and are the backbone of our economy in WA. You know, and they deserve, our residents and miners deserve, the need, the proper care and health needs that needs to meet their requirements. Didn't they announce a few months ago that there's a surplus in the budget? So what excuse is that? You know, they were meant to have the drawings done by end of 21 and it's still not here. And if they did that, we could have had the start rebuilding and maybe it wouldn't have been a big blowout in cost. And all I can say is if this was in the city, if there's a blowout, they'll find the money for it. So what makes us in the region, in remote areas, different? We contribute to the economy. We make a significant, you know, impact. Why aren't we getting the same service?
To assist travelling patients, the Cook government has increased the accommodation payment for people who have to travel for treatment by 66%. The Shire of Ashburton, which manages Tom Price, wants the WA Health Minister to come and visit the hospital as soon as possible.
If the Health Minister was in front of us today, I would just want to show her Kai and the other kids here and show her that their lives are the ones that we're talking about here.
That's Tom Price resident and mother Samantha Robbins ending that story from Pilbara reporter Charlie McLean. Let's head south to Tasmania now, where a mystery illness is wiping out millions of Pacific oysters in the southern waters of the state, and commercial growers don't know what's causing it. Farmers are desperate for licence fee relief and funding for research, as some consider closing altogether. Hobart reporter Fiona Breen has this story.
Pipeclay Lagoon, southeast of Hobart, was once the state's best oyster-growing area. But in the past 3 years, millions of oysters have died, and no one knows why. The state's biggest grower has moved its stock to other farms.
Josh Polk, Strategic Projects Manager, Tasmanian Oyster Company. Everyone in this bay has been struggling significantly over the last couple of years. It's gotten worse year on year. Fairly steep decline in production of our mature oysters. And on reflection, at the end of the year, we looked at our seed production and we'd lost close to 20 million oysters that year as well. We sort of halved our mature production, and that's just purely putting on-grown oysters onto our farm and letting them fatten. The year before, we'd produced about 120,000 dozen off it, and that year we did about 60,000 dozen. So that was sort of the first signs for us. And then, yeah, as I said, we looked at the seed production and looked at the number of oysters we put in as opposed to what we'd put out, plus what we had left on the farm. And in 2021 and 2022, we lost roughly 40 million oysters over those 2 years in stock under 8 mil.
We're in 2024 now. What's been the situation since those numbers?
Yeah, we're lucky enough that we've got other areas that we grow in. So we've had to scale up our seed production in those areas, and also look at pushing more matures through those areas as well. So this bay was representing close to 10% of our mature production, and most of our small seed oysters came through this bay at some point or another. You know, that was the plan anyway, so we've had to pivot significantly and use our other bays differently.
Obviously the oysters have just died, have they?
Yeah, the smaller oysters, we were losing 50, 60, 70% of the batches that were coming through, especially in the smaller sizes. We noticed that sort of above 8 mil, they'd perform a little bit better, but nowhere near where they should. And so, yeah, we had to make the decision to scale down the farm, and then we've nearly pulled out completely at this point in time.
For Pipeclay Lagoon's smaller farmers, that's not an option. They're facing increased seagrass growth, dry conditions and less food in the water.
Stephen Calvert from Clifton Pacific Oysters. So I've been here for almost 38 years. My family were pioneers in the industry.
And you've obviously seen it working beautifully in the past.
Yes, yes, we had a great run up until about 3 years ago when we noticed a lot of mortalities in the stock. We weren't sure what this was caused from. It happened since the influx of seagrass in the bay.
So you think there might be some correlation, but you're not sure?
Well, we don't know. We find it hard to get funding to research what the problem is.
So that's what you'd like to see, some scientists down here having a look?
Yes, absolutely.
It's that important, this bay, to the industry?
Yes, it is. It used to be one of the best growing areas in the state. Our production's dropped over the last 3 years by 70 to 80%. Lots of mortalities, slow growth in the stock.
Farmers are hoping the mystery illness is temporary, but with no cash coming in and state government fees ongoing, the clock is ticking.
Stuart Hansen from Albatross Fishing.
What's it done for your business?
It'll close me up. It'll shut me down. I mean, I've been here for 18 years, on growing 50 to 60 mil oysters to fatten within 6 months. I can't put stock on now because it's too volatile. It could die. And then buying that on-growing stock is expensive. And when you do your mathematics about it, you're just losing money. So.
And you're not paying yourself a salary at all?
No, I haven't paid myself for 8 months. So I've only costing me about $800 a day to get out of bed and come to work. So the fish have got to be handled, otherwise they foul up. I've got to pay an employee, so I've got to keep going and doing something to keep the farm within check. But it's only half full, but I can't put any more back on it, really. So eventually there I'll shut down within the next 6 months, I suppose. I'll have to give up.
Pipeclay Lagoon's struggling farmers are pleading for research funding to help solve the mystery that's threatening their livelihood.
Frances Huddlestone, Industry Development Officer from Oysters Tasmania.
Frances, must be difficult for you. You work for the Oysters Tasmania, the peak body. It must be difficult coming and talking to some of these farmers.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, it's really important for us as their representatives that that they stay in the industry. So it is. It's heartbreaking to see, I guess, the state that some of these farmers' businesses are in.
So what do you see needs to happen now?
Yeah, I think research, investigation, just better understand what has changed in the lagoon. From what references to what environmental data we have, nothing stands out as being that much of a cause or a difference that's brought it on, I guess.
So it's a wait and see and try and get something done before people go out of business.
Yeah, unfortunately that's the case, yep. But I mean, we have good connections within universities and with researchers, so it really is just about securing that funding to be able to take that to the next step.
Frances Huddleston from Tas Oysters, ending that report by Fiona Breen. And you can see more on Fiona's story and all of the stories featured on the program at the ABC News website. Just head to abc.net.au/news. And we end tonight on the New South Wales South Coast, where it's not unusual to see sand on the feet of Bulleye High School students or a line of surfboards drying in the playground. The school is a 60-second walk from Bulleye Beach and a couple of minutes further to one of the country's best surf breaks at Sandon Point. Now, the school is not only recognising its rich surfing past, but aiming to become a top-class training ground for future champions by ramping up its surfing program. Teacher David Strange told our reporter Justin Hunstall, the school is gathering names of students who have represented the state or country in surfing to be added to a commemorative surfboard that will be displayed in the school.
It was the principal's idea, and Jason Garver, who was our former school captain in 1989. Jason was also the Australian team captain in 1989. He made the board with his father-in-law, and the idea is we went and found the old 1956 logo of the school. We had that repaired, and we are now in the process of working with Sandepoint Board Riders and others to determine, I suppose you'd call it, the immortals of the school. And we've found about 14 people we think represented New South Wales or Australia. And that's the idea, to put their names in gold leaf. We're halfway there.
Amira Rankin, Year 12 student. My dad surfed his whole life and pretty much just pushed my brother, my sister and I into it. My sister didn't really get into it. They tried their best, but she never liked it. But me and my brother love it. And yeah, it's just such a good sport. You know, we do it every day, get to go around the world to do it. It's so good that we have Sandepoint here, like a world-class break that we get to practice on every day. And yeah, I think with surfing, you are never good enough. There's always room for improvement. But I've definitely been doing it since I was about... I got properly into it when I was about 11. I'd kind of been doing it since I was six, but started loving it when I was 11, and yeah, just pretty much done it every day since.
In terms of this honour board, what do you think it would mean for these previous surfers and maybe people like yourself to be honoured in this way by the school?
Yeah, I think it's so nice that they're acknowledging us, because I think surfing is a big part of this school. So I think that they're putting us all on the board, it's nice, and it's a cute part of history, I guess.
And for people who haven't visited Bulleye High School, just describe kind of where we are in proximity to the ocean, and as you mentioned, the role that the ocean and surfing plays amongst the students.
Yeah, we're about a 30-second walk to the beach. Most subjects we get to go down swimming and surfing and diving and stuff, so yeah, it's so good.
Denise James, Principal. This is really about bringing our community together. I have found it just so exhilarating to see how students are connected to where they live, connected to each other, and how amazing and talented they are at this particular sport. There are so many sports that kids are good at and so many sports that are competitive, and I think that surfing is sometimes not recognised quite the same way, and it really needs to be, particularly in this community. We're so proud of the past. We're coming up to our 70th anniversary in 2 years, and so that's got me thinking a lot about, you know, the history of this school, what we do need to celebrate and who has had an impact here. So this has been a really great way of meeting new people, meeting ex-students, current students, parents, other community members, people just so willing to get involved and support the future generations. That to me is what is so lovely.
And can you elaborate a little bit more on some of the other elements of the surfing program that's offered to students and how that's changed this year?
So this year the changes have been that we've really, I guess, formalised a surfing program. So there's been trials. We have really amazing coaches, a lot of ex-alumni and other people that are helping us. And we are really recognising that students need to not only improve or be coached in their surfing, but also in their lifestyle habits, in planning for the future and looking at surfing as a career and the different options that come with that.
We're moving towards things like financial planning, obviously mental health. We're looking at things around nutrition. And also one of the better moments this year was being with Dr. Scott Winch, atop Sandepoint, and talking about creation stories and talking about an Aboriginal perspective of the ocean. So it's about making the kids well-rounded and making them members of the community. I suppose we're proud of the idea that we see it as a cottage industry. As Amira said, we're like 30 seconds from the ocean. So why wouldn't we get kids who are already artists and musicians and designers to be a part of this movement? We're hoping to build a recording studio, and the idea is that we will make some surf music. We will also, through the multiverse, we'll get kids designing surfboards and designing t-shirts, and we'd like to think that we can make well-rounded individuals.
This school is actually letting us have tutors of ex-students. So there's a tutor, her name's Lardie Taylor, and she's coming in, is it once a week, to tutor the surfing kids, and just to make sure that with the amount of sport they're doing, they're not kind of falling behind on school. And yeah, they're doing breakfast in the mornings to make it a bit fun as well. So yeah.
That's Bulleye High School student Amira Rankin, ending that story from Illawarra reporter Justin Hunsdale. And that is Australia Wide for this Wednesday. I'm Alex Hyman. I'll be back again with you tomorrow. Thanks so much for your company. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.